I would like to discuss this morning the biblical root of the idea of human dignity. The first aspect of this discussion will center on the biblical conception of a moral order. Now, in the biblical conception of reality, one can see God providing reality for at least four different relations. There's God in relation to nature or creation, God in relation to history, God in relation to the moral judgment, and God in relation to the human being and human existence. But the moral judgment is basic. It underlies all relations. Nothing seems to be exempt from the moral judgment. Even in creation, the moral judgment was supreme. As I mentioned to you on Monday, there was the refrain in chapter 1, after each day of creation, and God saw it was good. That's a moral judgment. And the impact, the purport, and the importance of this can hardly be exaggerated. It is an all-sweeping concern with the moral judgment. For human history, all nature finds itself implicated in the operation of the moral law. There are countless instances of this. One typical one is in Deuteronomy chapter 30. The Lord your God will make you abundantly prosperous in all the work of your hand, in the fruit of your body, in the fruit of your cattle, in the fruit of your ground, for the Lord will again take delight in prospering you as he took delight in your fathers, if you obey the voice of the Lord your God, to keep his commandments and the statutes which are written in this book of the law, if you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. See, I have set before you this day life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you this day, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, by keeping his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances, then you shall live and multiply. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you are entering to take possession. But if your heart turns away and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you this day that you will perish. You will not live long in the land which you are going over the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I've set before you life and death, blessing and the curse. Therefore choose life, that you and your descendants may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, cleaving to him, for that means life to you and length of days. Now, this is typical of the way the Bible involves the moral law with the very air that men breathe, the soil which is supposed to sustain them, water, scenery, the ocean, the mountains, heaven and earth get implicated in the moral or immoral doings of men. It shouldn't seem very strange to us because today we easily make these translations in terms of ecology. We do, by our actions, involve the air, the soil, water, the very skies, the ocean, everything gets involved. And we do now, at long last, extend our moral judgment to involve what man does with respect to the implications for the rest of creation. Even animal life, of course, fish and wildlife, everything gets to be pulled in. Now, the Bible begins with creation, and it does it because of a logic that is implicit in the very substance of the biblical approach. It couldn't have been left out. For the basic argument throughout is that the same God who created the sun and the moon and the stars and the earth and life itself also created the laws by which nature is governed. The Declaration of Independence uses the phrase, the laws of nature and of nature's God. This is a perfectly biblical conception. The laws of nature are the laws of nature's God. God made, this is the way the Bible views it. God made the order of nature, and it is an order. It is a cosmos, which the term cosmos means, order. It's not a chaos. On the contrary, the chaos ended when God created. So there are the laws of nature that govern nature, for they are the laws of God. Then, on the sixth day, God created man in his own image, and he gave man dominion over the earth. And a moral law came into being for the governance of human life. The laws of nature are fixed and unalterable. The rainbow is supposed to be the seal, the emblem of God's promise that this is the way nature would operate. The moral order and the whole burden of the Bible moves in that direction. The moral order is equally in force, just as the order of nature is in force, so the moral order is in force. The same God who made the laws for the operation of the earth and the sun and the moon made the laws that are supposed to be operative for man. This is assumed in the story of Cain and Abel. It is assumed in the story of Noah and the flood. Long before there was any revelation, long before there were the proclamation of Ten Commandments or anything else like that, there was a moral law operative. The moral law did not need to wait for Mount Sinai or the Sermon on the Mount or any other such event, natural or supernatural. It was there with the creation of Adam and Eve. There's an unwritten constitution, as it were, an unwritten code of laws, binding on mankind everywhere and at all times. These laws are not king-made, they are not man-made, and no king may abrogate them. No government can repeal them. This, of course, is the basis for the conception of the belief in the higher law, as we sometimes speak of it, every conscientious objector claimed to believe in a higher law. He didn't have to point to a constitution or to a law enacted by Congress. He believed in a higher law, in a basic, in a code of basic fundamental human rights. It's the underlying conception of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which is supposed to be operative throughout the world, wherever human beings live. It doesn't need to be enacted by any government. And no government may adopt a law or a system which violates the fundamental human rights, a fundamental moral law. We speak of the conscience, the compulsions of conscience, the laws of conscience. We speak of natural rights. And the Western man spoke of natural rights for many, many centuries, up to practically our own time. We don't use the term natural rights, but we have circumlocutions for that. We have the Ninth Amendment today in the Constitution, which is used as a kind of a substitute for natural rights. Where do you find the right of privacy? We don't find it in the Constitution, not in the written Constitution. So the argument is that the Ninth Amendment has left a lot of rights that inhere in human beings that are not mentioned in the other amendments that constitute the Bill of Rights. There are fundamental human rights which human beings are supposed to believe in. So the conception should not be strange to you if you make the translation from one language into another, which is exactly, of course, what the Ecumenical Council did in Rome with its proclamations of beliefs in fundamental human rights. You can easily translate from the Bible into a secular language or from the secular language into the Bible, but the Bible is the basis in our culture historically, has been the basis for this fundamental belief. And I'm trying to explain to you the logic which is inherent in the biblical thought with respect to this. Now, it is this basic biblical postulate that the moral law, no less than the physical law, is founded in creation. That is the key to an understanding of the book of Job, to take one outstanding example. Let me discuss that this book with you. So I'm sure you can stand a little help in trying to work your way through it. The book comes to the moral question, the book of Job comes to the moral question through the observation which is made throughout the Bible, time and time again, but everybody knows that the righteous do suffer and that very often the wicked do flourish. Nobody can deny that. You have to bury your head in the sand and live in a world of fictions not to see that this is the case. Well, Stalin died in bed, in a comfortable bed. A lot of other evil men died at a ripe old age, comfortably, respected. Men stood in awe and in fear of them. While an awful lot of perfectly decent human beings, righteous men, as the Bible would refer to them, languished in prisons and died in concentration camps. Well, now, the book of Job faces this question, this problem, and asks the question, where then is justice? What does justice mean in such a world? If God is just, and there isn't any question but that Job believes in God, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Nobody can question Job's belief. And God, the God he believes in, is a God who is just. He's the ruler of the world and the judge, the lawgiver. Well, if God is just, then is not the human world, all of human history, a contradiction, a denial of God's power? Either it's a denial of his power, either he's powerless, or he is not just. He is not good. Either one of these alternatives is unthinkable. He has the power, but if he has the power and he is just and he is good, then how can one explain the human condition, the human scene? Now, Job doesn't think of himself as a man who deserved all the suffering, the pain and suffering that came to him. In chapter 31 of the book of Job, he speaks of himself and he paints a portrait of a person who is innocent. It's a portrait of the biblical man of righteousness. It's a fine, beautiful portrait. I have made a covenant here. Let me read parts of it. If I have walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance and let God know my integrity. If my step has turned aside from the way, my heart has gone after my eyes, and if any spot has cleaved to my hands, then let me sow and let another man eat, and let what grows for me be rooted out. If my heart has been enticed to a woman, and I have lain in wait at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another, and let others bow down upon her. For that would be a grave crime. That would be an iniquity to be punished by the judges. That would be a fire which consumes unto Abaddon, which is another name for Sheol, or the place where the dead go, the shades of men. And it would burn to the root of all my increase. If I have rejected the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they brought a complaint against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he makes inquiry, what shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb? If I have withheld anything that the poor desired, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the fatherless has not eaten of it, for from his youth I reared him, as a father, and from his mother's womb I guided him. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or a poor man without covering, if his loins have not blessed me, and if he was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless because I saw help in the gate, then let my shoulder blade fall from my shoulder, and let my arm be broken from its socket. For I was in terror of calamity from God, and I could not have faced his majesty. And so he goes on to portray his innocence. And as I said, it's a fine portrait of a man who lives by the moral law. And yet, see what happened to him. Incidentally, Job is not portrayed as a Jew. As a matter of fact, he's not a Jew. He's referred to, from all accounts, as one who was not. The moral law operates for anyone and not merely for the Israelite. Purposely, I think, the portrait of Job was that of just every man, any man, wherever he might be. Now, Job's friends tried to explain his suffering by speaking of his guilt, because they are simple people, and to them, if God is just, and of course God is just, then anyone who suffers must suffer because he's guilty. He is sinful. The moral law has to operate just in that way, cause and effect relationship, a one-to-one relationship. And they say to Job that it is blasphemy for him or anyone else to question God's justice. Then there is the fourth friend who comes into the book at a later point, who doesn't use the argument of the others, but has the argument which later on in Isaiah and in other biblical references became the idea of the suffering servant. Suffering may come to Job, may come to anyone who may be innocent, he may be pious, he may be righteous, but it comes to him as a form of education, of the moral will, a form of moral discipline, because the conscience can easily fall asleep. It falls into a routine, and a man tries to see only what he does and forgets about the environment, which may be an evil one, and he does nothing to change his society, his surroundings, tries to keep just himself clean. So suffering may come to wake up a person who may not be evil at all. He may, as a matter of fact, be on the whole, no man is perfect, but by and large, a just man, a righteous man. Oh, but the suffering may come to him, and it is not meaningless then. It comes in order to teach him to become broader in his horizons and to develop himself morally more than he has done. But then comes the voice out of the whirlwind in chapters 38 and beyond that. And this is God, as it were, speaking to Job to provide an answer to his questions, implying clearly that the four friends did not give the answer. And they don't, of course. Their answer, except for Elihu, the fourth friend, is one aspect which has some meaning. But the first three friends certainly do not understand the operation of the moral law. In the voice out of the whirlwind, the Lord speaks to Job. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me." And just listen to how this goes back to creation. "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it, the plumb line? On what words bases sunk, or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed bounds for it, and set bars and doors, and said, 'Thus far you shall come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed.' Where is the way to the dwelling of light? Where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the paths to its home? You know, For you were born then, and the number of your days is great. And then there's a turn to animal creation. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their covert? Who provides for the raven when its young ones cry to God and they wander about for lack of food? Do you know when the mountain goats bring forth? Do you observe the calving of the hinds? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they bring forth, when they crouch, bringing forth their offspring and are delivered of their young? The young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go forth and do not return to them. And it goes on with other animals. Is it by your wisdom that the hawk soars and spreads his wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the rock he dwells and makes his home in the fastness of the rocky crag. There's the wonderful picture of the hippopotamus, behemoth. The whole behemoth which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold his strength and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs like bars of iron. What's the meaning of that? The meaning obviously is that Job does not understand the ways of God with his creation. He cannot explain creation on any level. There's so little that he knows and so much that he does not know. So why should he presume to know the ways of God in the moral realm? God made both realms with different laws that are operated. Since Job doesn't understand the laws of nature, the little that he knows hardly suffices to be called knowledge when compared with the ocean of ignorance. In the same way, he must assume that he must be ignorant of the ways of God in the moral realm. Yes? I do. Let me say something about that right now. The New Testament was written by Jews, with the exception of the book of Luke and the book of Acts. Acts was probably also written by Luke. There's a continuity, and the Christian believes this, between the Old and the New Testament. But what I'm talking about, what I'm saying, comes out to a very considerable degree also in the New Testament. There is a lapse of some centuries between the two, and Judaism itself underwent some changes in the period between the two testaments, so that the early Christians, who were to begin with Jews, reflected to a very considerable degree biblical and post-biblical Jewish conceptions. What I've been saying doesn't represent any discontinuity, but a continuity between the two. There was a time, let me answer this, because I think it's an important question, it's a serious question, and deserves some consideration. And I'll pick up the train of thought on which I was launched in just a few minutes. There was, after Christianity came into existence, at the end of the first century, in the beginning of the second century, after the early Christians turned to the Gentiles to convert them, this was the result of a dispute between Paul and Peter as to whether or not they should attempt to go beyond the Jewish community to seek converts. The decision was made to do that. There developed among the Christians who came into Christianity with a pagan background a movement who was not a god of power, but a god of love. Eventually, in some way, the god of love would supplant the god of power. But it was the god of power who created the world. And he was concerned with matter, with the material universe, and all that's related in Genesis was his work. The god of love is the god of pure spirit. They made a sharp differentiation between matter and spirit. And Martian and his followers argued for the total disassociation of the two religions and the discarding of the Old Testament. The fathers of the church branded Martian an arch heretic, and the Martianite heresy became the almost a prime enemy of Christianity. There were a great many Martian churches in the old world, and the conflict between the Orthodox Christians and the Martian heretics constitute some of the most important events in the early years. The church took the position that the two testaments are inseparable, that Genesis is as much a part of the Christian Bible as is Mark or Luke, and that it is a heresy to deny the validity of the Old Testament. Martian thought that one way of meeting, and this was incidental, the problem that Job posed was through this separation. Because, as I put it to you before, if God is the God of power, then why doesn't he do something if he's also a God of justice? So maybe he doesn't have the power, or maybe he isn't just. Well, Martian said, that's right. He is a God of power, but he's not a God of love. He's a God of justice, but in a non-Christian sense of justice, with which Christianity ought to have nothing to do. So what I'm talking about is something which is continuous through the New Testament. If I select something to be read from the Old Testament, it doesn't mean to imply that the New Testament would necessarily contradict it. Yes? Okay. Well, I'm glad you asked about it. Oh, but you may not get involved, but I do get involved because by implication, you charged me with the opposite of Martianism, that is, as one who, in his teaching here, regardless of my personal religion, discards one of the two testaments. I wouldn't do that here. Yeah.
Why is there suffering in the world? Why is there suffering?
I don't deny that, but give me a chance to say some things. You know, this is only the second week of a discussion which is going to last a month. I can't say everything in the first hour or two. Well, I'm coming to it. I'll get to it. I know it's important. Well, why don't you give me an opportunity? Why don't you try to listen to me? Listen to me sympathetically, trying to figure out what I'm trying to say, which may help you in your own understanding. Don't assume that your answer, the answer that you, excuse me, let's listen to, this is important here. I think it's important for all of us. You can start off with the assumption that whatever the question, you already have the answer. I'm not trying to disturb your beliefs. Believe me that. That's your faith, and that's fine. But what I may have to say, if you listen, may help you and may strengthen your belief. Don't jump to the conclusion that what I have to say, because it isn't the way you would put it, would necessarily tend to try to, for me to undermine your belief. Well, don't worry about them. I think they're all complex. Every person in here has his own background. But I haven't completed. I haven't completed what the Bible says. I still have a lot more to say about what the Bible has to say. And what I have said is not untrue. Now, it doesn't mean that it's the whole truth. Of course it isn't. There's a lot more to be said. If you can catch me at saying something which isn't so, then it seems to me I ought to know about it, and I ought to be told about it, and I ought to try to correct that. But if what I'm saying isn't the whole truth, I grant you, even at the end of a month, I will still not have said the whole truth. I'm not going to be able to give you the whole picture. I'm only trying to get you to see how a certain conception of moral dignity, which is important to us, we all talk about moral dignity, how that is rooted in the Bible. Now, it may be rooted in the Bible in other ways than in the way in which I present it. Well, that's fine. I have no objection to that. But I have to present it from the way I see it. And nobody has taught me except I myself. I've taught myself in terms of my scholarship, of my hard work to try to understand this. I can't stand here and think the way you think and give the class the answer that you have in your mind. Don't expect that from me. But I can expect you to try to hear what I have to say on the subject. I'm not at Sinai. I made that clear to you a long time ago. I don't pretend to be giving you a revelation. So don't take me that seriously. Take me seriously, but not that seriously. Well, now, let me go back to Job. In chapter 42, after having heard the voice out of the whirlwind, then Job answered the Lord, "I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. I had heard of thee," he says to the voice, "I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." Now, this can only be understood if you bear in mind the kind of logic in the Bible that I spoke to you about. Connections are missing. There is no syllogism. There is no Aristotelian logic that operates here. There are a lot of things that are skipped. It's like in the story of Abraham and the sacrifice of Isaac, according to Auerbach. There are wide spaces that are not filled. We have to supply them ourselves. But what this has been taken to mean, I've read a great deal about Job. The explanation that seems to me to make most sense is that Job is trying to say that God still remains a hidden God. He does not understand a great deal. God does not reveal to Job his reasons for his actions. There is no explanation that the voice out of the whirlwind gives to Job for his suffering. That's the essential question. Why do I suffer so much? But you can't find an explanation for that question except by the implication that God is a hidden God. But he operates, and his moral law operates. And Job believes that whether he understands or not, the moral law operates. The same law that operates for Behemoth, for the hippopotamus, for the lion, for the things that were created the first day, all of which are recited by Job, by the voice out of the whirlwind, and Job hears that. God is a hidden God with respect to them, but nonetheless we know that his law works. And so Job now understands that the moral order of the universe, whether he understands it or not, operates. And he's therefore reconciled to whatever has happened. It reminds me of what Einstein once said, "I shall never believe that God plays games with the world. The Lord God is subtle, but malicious he is not." Essentially, Einstein was reflecting a Jobian position. This was the essence, I think, of what Job was trying to say. It's in that kind of a setting that the biblical man finds his human dignity. He's a moral being, and he's living in a world in which the moral law operates. And in that kind of a world, he has his place. Because that kind of a world is not meaningless from the moral point of view. It's not chaotic. It's not confusion. He doesn't understand it, but there are lots of things that human beings didn't understand. Until our own day, we didn't send a man to the moon until only a couple of years ago. And, of course, we still don't know a great, great deal. But nonetheless, we assumed that there were laws that were operative. We kept looking for them. But most of them remain hidden. And so the same kind of a situation is reflected in the Bible with regard to the operation of the human world and the moral world. I want to continue and conclude this, but we have only a few minutes, and I don't think I ought to start on the next aspect. We have 2-3 minutes. Anybody have an easy question? Yes. Excuse me, but I didn't hear a word. Martian, I think, was in the second century, but he may have been born at the end of the first, I'm not quite sure, but not later than the second century. Anything else?